Hey, everyone, and welcome to my first podcast, Insights. The name of the podcast was based on an idea notion that every episode, you will have one insight or nugget of knowledge after listening to our guest speakers. I'm Ben Siegel, a managing director in private wealth management at UBS Financial Services. Our team is called Connor and Siegel Partners, and we are based in New York City. Following the podcast, I can be reached at benjamin.siegel@ubs.com. Today, we have our first guest. He's not affiliated with UBS, and his views are his own. Our guest is Rob Chang, the CEO of PCmatic, a well-respected cybersecurity company. Cybersecurity is a well-known topic, but I don't believe individuals and business entities fully understand the reality of cybersecurity versus our perception. Rob, welcome. Are we safe in the digital world?
Hi, Ben. Nice to be here. I do not think we are safe in the digital world. I mean, things since really cybersecurity started getting bad in 2013, that was the first ransomware, and every year it keeps on getting worse. And now we're in two wars. These are two wars that is going to be the first two wars that cyber is a big element in, and we are not safe at home. I mean, that's what ransomware should be telling us. So I do not believe we are safe.
So as a country, as a small business, as a medium business, why, with all the cybersecurity software that's out there, is there still issues? It seems like the amount of ransomware and infiltrations has gone up significantly over time. What can we do?
So one thing I think the listeners should know is that there is not a national defense for cybersecurity. If all of a sudden a city, for example, was being hit by an air attack from another country, our Air Force would get involved. So the city itself does not need to worry about that happening. But we don't have that on cyber. We have assets on cyber in our military, but they cannot be repurposed to protect, for example, cities. So that's answer number one. The second answer to your question is this, is that it's very, I'm going to say, patchwork our cybersecurity, and there's a way to approach it. So there's a framework. And right now, it is very much ad hoc with anybody's doing, whether it's a small business, a large business. If you look at the problem, it goes across everything. The federal government's getting infected, a large organizations. Right now, even the small organizations, it doesn't even make the news anymore. If a K-12 gets hit with ransomware and all the students can't go to school, that's not in the news. I mean, it's only when a large organization now, but they are the biggest of the big, the ones with all the money and all the cybersecurity expertise are now getting hit. And so they will be exposed during a nation state attack as well.
Before we go into the corporate enterprise, what are some areas that have no cyber protection that could penetrate our systems, like the Internet of Things?
Yeah, I mean, it is in a very sad state right now. Absolutely. One thing that I worry about is a nation state attack. And every single year, I feel like we are more vulnerable toward that. I mean, and my fear is two things. Number one is an automated attack, and it would attack everything. Not just right now, you know, we have, for every ransomware, there's one victim. There's a nation state, it would be one attack and multiple victims. And so that has not happened in our country yet, but it's there to be done. And then the other thing is called, as you were talking about, Internet of Things. And that scares me because there is no security software on any of those Internet of Things. So they can be transformed into becoming surveillance. And this has already happened. This happened in the country of Guam. That's where we have our military base. I mean, that was exposed through surveillance software into the cable modems. And so no Internet of Things has a security software. Internet of Things right now in 2023 is one half of all the devices on the internet, which is something like 15 billion devices, and not one of them have any security software.
So there's 15 billion nodes of possible attacks.
Yes.
So what is someone to do if you have a small business or medium-sized business? First, if there is an attack, what do you do? And second, before there's an attack, what do you do?
So one of the most important things that I think in order for us to get well is to focus more on prevention. What's happened over the last 10 years, I told you 2013 is when this really began, over the last 10 years is that the country is focused on reaction. It's saying, once it gets in, what do we do? Actually, that was the question you just asked me. Well, there's so many solutions out there. The problem with ransomware and automated attacks is that it's moving so fast that there's not really a lot you can do. right? And so then you end up with the worst case situation where you're recovering, everything's down, you're trying to use insurance, you're trying to back up, you know, those kind of things. And really where we need to move is to a balancing. We should have some reaction. We also should focus on prevention. And that's what the many frameworks are saying to do, is that don't just, you know, buy a bunch of things and hope it works. I mean, it should be, you know, buy it according to a framework. And there's many frameworks out there. The one that I like is called the NIST Cybersecurity Framework. And then if you, which is a nice balance between prevention and reaction, and to buy against that. And I believe that if you do that, number one, the cost of cybersecurity should decline, and then your protection levels will go up.
Right. So with regards to cybersecurity, is there different types of software that do different things? I guess the one label versus the black label.
Well, that's all part of the framework. So if you're doing what they call whitelisting, right? Whitelisting is prevention. What NIST is saying is that you should really know everything that's on your network. And this goes for everybody. This is foundational. You should know all the people are supposed to be on your network. All the hardware should be on your network. And the most important one, all the software that should be on your network should all be authorized. And the thing that, Ashley, that I want to talk about is on the software, there's two things you want to know about the software on your network. Number one, who made it? So if there's some software on your network and you don't know who made it, it shouldn't run. And that's kind of solves your ransomware problem, because the ransomware people don't want you to know who made it. This is part of the biggest problem we have, which is attribution. Because if you know who made it, and then it ends up being ransomware, then, well, now we have attribution back to who made it. We have an address, we have people, and we can go after them. But right now, they're just coming in totally anonymous, and nobody knows who made it. Secondly, you should know, for any piece of software on your network, why it's on the network. Just because you know who made it, let's say Microsoft makes a game that's very popular, but you don't want it on your network because it does not have a business purpose. So you should know who made it, and we should know what business purpose does it solve.
If you're a large corporation, you'd have the resources to be able to find out who's on your network versus a small to medium-sized enterprise. What would you suggest for them?
Well, actually, this is all a function of automation, right? I think all of this is possible through automation in today's day and age, is to automate the process of knowing what hardware is on your network. I mean, that's normally through your router, you know, on a home network. You know, on the software is the same thing. That's what kind of my company has done. And obviously, the people on your network, you should want to know who that is. I mean, any organization should want to do that.
So if I'm a non-tech business owner, how do I immerse myself in helping my organization in preventive defense against cyber intrusions? And what can I do as a CEO of a company or CFO?
I think that right now, I mean, industry has failed. I think that, I mean, if, for example, it was a really good use case, let's call it a small business, non-technical, let's call it a urgent care, or, you know, K-12 is another use case, and they don't know a lot about cybersecurity. And so rather than try to solve that problem, okay, you don't have to do anything, just leave it to us. They're just trying to figure out what they will buy. And they've been selling a lot of things that aren't working. But I think that if people follow the frameworks, we will have, you know, more solutions in the future that will get them there.
So if I'm a family office again or a corporate enterprise, I want to go pivot a little bit toward the insurance. What is your view of cyber insurance? If I'm an insurance executive, how should I be looking at it to improve my odds of less claims through cyber?
I just talked to you about this a few minutes ago. I feel that cybersecurity insurance has failed. I think that they is an excellent opportunity. They have not measured the risk properly. The risk is right now, as we talked about in the beginning, keeps on growing, and we need to be able to measure these risks. And then we can insure against them. And we need to be able to assess, you know, which organizations are running the highest risks versus the lowest risks, and figure out what those metrics are. And then when they actually does happen, let's suppose that there, you know, someone does get impacted, then they can go and adjust the risk models. And they have not done that. I know a lot of people that have been impacted that have had cybersecurity insurance. I mean, the cybersecurity insurance industry almost went under, you know, during ransomware, because they underestimated the risk to cybersecurity. When they do pay the ransoms, actually, I don't think they're doing that anymore. We're trying to write laws against that. But I mean, when they do, they don't realize that that increases the risk that everyone else will go and get infected. And that needed to be comprehended in their models.
So I'm sure the losses are now in the trillions of dollars with the ransomware plus the additional cost. What do you think the government can do to effectively deter some state actors or regular hackers?
There's numerous answers to that question. First off, you know, the government has been trying since the very beginning to try to find these people. And because of the attribution problem, they cannot. The software, so that, you know, it's better for users to be able to attribute every piece of software to some organization somewhere, but and not let things in that are not. But so they, the government and the FBI, their books written about this, they fail. They at times they're able to figure out who they are, but then they're, you know, we can't extradite to them. So therefore that they're living outside of our laws, you know, and no one disagrees that it's against the law what they're doing, but we can't get to them.
So when a firm or a family office or a business enterprise, again, when they're deciding to have an effective cyber defense plan, should they logically think about it? And how should they, when they choose the software, what should they be looking for?
You mean software just in general or software to protect them?
Software for cyber defense, cybersecurity.
So if you, the NIST cybersecurity framework, there's five parts.
NIST is, again?
National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Right. And who actually runs that?
I mean, it's run out of the federal government. I mean, okay. I've been there. They're my friends. I mean, it's a very nice, a lot of very smart intellectual people that have worked there for decades.
Right.
So, I mean, the framework says first is identify and then protect, detect, respond, recover. So there's five things. Identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. So the first thing they're saying, and I just went over it, is that you need to identify all the things on your network. It starts right there. If you don't do that, it's kind of like the foundation of your house. You don't have a foundation. You have to know what people should be on your network, what software, and what hardware. And what we've done, and if you look at this framework, is we were spending all of our time in detect, respond without understanding that first. And then you have protect. Right. And so let me just give the listeners, there's some simple things that I think that every single person, whether you're a big company, little company, individual, they should do. Number one, on your computers, you should have a password. I mean, these are the really basic things in the framework, and not everyone's doing it. Number two, if you ever get up from your computer, you should log off so that you have to put that password back in again. Right. And number three is that you should be the only one that knows that password. Where you start there, so that's number one. And then number two is, but I just explained, to know your people on your network, know the software on your network, and know the hardware on your network. And number three is back up your data. So it's not that complicated to get these things, but we haven't got those first two. And a lot of our organizations don't have passwords on their devices. It's kind of scary, actually.
Yeah, it seems that way. It seems right. Like some simple measures.
It's just very simple. I mean, I don't think what I'm saying is that hard for people to comprehend. They're trying to make it in cybersecurity to be very complicated. But what NIST is trying to do is make this framework so it's quite simple. And I think we will get there. I'm optimistic at this point, even though it keeps on getting worse.
So our listeners would understand. So what is the actual process when an attack occurs? It comes in from one way. The software is supposed to block it. And what happens when they're not able to block it? Or is it a lot of times just human error by allowing phishing emails into the network?
Well, that's all true. I mean, so it gets in numerous ways into a network. So let's go through each one. First one you just mentioned is email, right? And so actually you should train your employees. It's not foolproof about how ransomware gets into your network. And very frequently, either they have given up their credentials to get onto the network, or they click on something in one of their emails. Now, as I was talking before, if they click on it, that's your payload. That's your payload right there. It's already in the network. So the question is whether it's going to execute. And so boom, where you need to catch it is saying, well, who made that software? Well, you can't define who it is. Well, then it doesn't get on.
That's considered whitelisting.
Yes, right. And so that's what's not happening today, right, is software asset management. We don't know what's supposed to be on the network, so we got to let that one go through. And that's happening a lot. I mean, this is happening millions of times a day, right? So there's that one. The other one has to do with what we call patch management. And patch management is when you have a piece of good software and then all of a sudden it has a security hole in it. Let's use Excel, right? It's something everyone knows. And then all of a sudden they can get in that way. Now, the beautiful thing is that once they get in, Then they go and try to run the ransomware. Again, it goes through the same process. Well, who made it? Why are you here? Right? And all of a sudden, that one, even if they come in through that way, it still doesn't get in. And the other one is if they got the credentials. They got your credentials. They can pretend they're you, but then you're trying to deploy that ransomware, and then they double-click on it, and that one doesn't get in because it's still not authorized. The key thing is that you need everything on your network should be authorized. That's what the National Institute of Standards and Technology are saying.
Right. And does artificial intelligence compound the issues that cyber defense will have to consider?
Well, that's a big subject. I mean, we've tried so that's over in the detect and respond piece. So that's kind of saying, well, we can do those things, but it's still not going to be successful until we do the first piece. The reason why it keeps on getting worse is we're not doing the first pieces of the framework, which is identify. We need to know what's supposed to be on the network. And if you don't do that and do AI, you might do better, but it's still not the way, that's not the way it should work.
So do you think data, stealing of data, is more prevalent or ransomware? And if you're penetrated and as an individual, your data is stolen, what are you supposed to do?
Okay. Ransomware, that's what ransomware has evolved. In the beginning, it would just encrypt your data. It didn't even steal it. So then you were just down because you need your data in order to operate. And so, but then what they started doing is that they would encrypt your data and then they're stealing it too. And so in some instances now, the ransomware is stealing the data and not encrypting it. Because sometimes they can get in, steal data, but they don't have enough so they can go and shut down your network. And that's been happening a lot. So that's the answer one, is that ransomware is stealing data and then trying to make sure that it doesn't get divulged out to the real world. This has happened a lot, actually. Hospital information has been out there. K-12 information, our kids' information is already out there on the dark web because of this. So a lot of information being stolen. What I say, you know, is that when your information is stolen, there's not a whole lot you can do once you learn about it. I mean, you can monitor, you know, that you have, and I don't really like you have the credit monitoring. And so once your information stolen is out there, but all of our information, I'll be honest with everybody, all of our information has been stolen. All of our passwords have been stolen. All of our social security numbers are stolen. I mean, it's all out there to be purchased right now. Yours and mine. It's been out there for quite some time.
That's very frightening.
Well, it's actually more frightening for where you work. I mean, because, I mean, if you and I get compromised, one, the bank, by law, the banks are supposed to cover that because we're consumers. But then, I mean, it is, I mean, this happened to my mother. I mean, after you go and get compromised, you're just at a restaurant or something, random place, and all of a sudden, you're not you anymore, right? And so, I mean, and then you go back to the bank, they'll make you good on the money, but you've just gone through a lot more inconvenience. I mean, when somebody has stolen your identity. But that's happening as not as much as using all that information to get into where you work. That's what they're using all this information for. And then the numbers, I mean, I'm not going wrong, but the Marriott, I mean, if anyone's a Marriott customer, all that database got stolen. Where I live, the Department of Revenue got hit in 2012. And so, you know, all my Social Security information, all my tax information, all that was out there.
So what did you do?
Oh, actually, and on top of that, so Nikki Haley was a governor. What Nikki did is she gave everyone in our state credit monitoring through Experian. But then Experian got hit. And so Experian had a lot of them. So they got hit and Equifax got hit. So all that information's out there, all of it.
So I'm sitting in an office and I'm listening to your conversation and I'm starting to shake in my boots a little bit. And then I think, okay, what should I look for in a person to oversee my cybersecurity program, my defenses? How should I look when I hire someone to oversee that? What are the criteria and what would you do if you're an organization? What is the right person for that kind of job?
So, yeah, that's what a lot of people are doing. Say, I don't know anything about cybersecurity. I need to hire into it, right?
Right.
Well, you know, and I'm CEO of a company. Hiring for something that you don't know how to do, that's really, really one of the hardest things you're ever going to do as a CEO is try to do that. I mean, so, you know, I'm very good at marketing, so I'm never worried about hiring a marketing person. But here's all these CEOs all of a sudden have to, I need to hire a cybersecurity person. And they don't know how to hire that person. So that's what's happened is that since so many CEOs don't know what they're trying to hire, they end up not hiring very good people because they didn't know. How would you know? right? And these positions pay very, very well.
Yes, I've heard that.
It's probably one of the fastest growing positions. Actually, there's a shortage of these people because they don't do the position well. So therefore, more people are getting infected and there's an escalation of salaries and all that. I would suggest what I'm saying before is the NIST cybersecurity framework. Some people that really understand and are willing to follow that framework, I think will do it. And if they don't like the NIST cybersecurity framework, I think a good question to ask them, well, what framework are you following? Because if you're just going to go to trade shows and buy a bunch of stuff and then, you know, get you to spend more money, that's really what's happening in cybersecurity. And that's what's not working. It's just very patchwork. I mean, there has to be a strategy for all the things that you purchase.
But there's no university or college that gives you an accreditation to at least give you a little bit of comfort that someone's a cyber expert.
What they're doing in the university, so education has definitely been part of cybersecurity, but what they're doing, you know, is that if you look at detect and respond, that's what we call the Security Operations Center. I'm sure UBS has a really nice big one, is to find people to go and work in those organizations to be able to respond to the cyber threats once they're in the network. And that is definitely a growing position that they're trying to train for.
So do you think in the school systems, they should be teaching young children on cyber, and so time they graduate, because I mean the world's pretty much digital, but it'll be even more digital when, you know, over the next 10 years, 15 years.
As young as you can. I mean, there's so much that needs to be taught. I mean, right now we're scrambling as if people are hiring new people. Those people need to have a certain level of cybersecurity knowledge before they actually get on the network, because they are a risk to the entire organization if they're not.
And then the follow-up question is, the company looks at software. What are the things that they should look for? And does a track record at other companies matter?
So another way to look at it, and this goes back to the cybersecurity insurance. I mean, the cybersecurity insurance should be able to tell what software works and what software doesn't. Because, if they knew everything that was purchased for that organization, let's use actually a really good one was the Colonial Pipeline.
Yes.
If they had insurance, then they would, the cybersecurity insurance company would know all the things, and they would know all the things that failed. And therefore, and they would be able to see, okay, well, these are the products that are working, these are the ones that are not. Right now, it's very opaque. Nobody knows what's working and what's not. We know that something is not. Whenever there's a ransomware infection, a successful one, we know that something failed in that cybersecurity stack, but nobody knows what it is. It's kind of like, you know, when an airplane goes down,
right,
there's a big investigation to figure out what went wrong. Something failed, whether that was the pilot, whether that was the black box, whether that was, you know, mechanical error. There's a big investigation. We don't have any of that information in cyber, so we don't know what's failing and which products hence to buy. So then it just becomes a crapshoot. And you go to a trade show, you know, and then everyone's just drinking, have a good time. There's a band playing, and then you choose your software.
Right, right. And the mindset of the hackers, intruders, where do they come from? Is it domestic, foreign? And how do we understand their mindset? Obviously, if they're looking for money, the ransomware. And is there any specific places that, well, my basic question is, what can we do in addition to training the employees, getting the software? Is understanding the mindset of the hackers, does that help in any way?
You know, I think right now the hackers, I mean, I think that over time they could evolve to something more nefarious, but right now it's just trying to figure out how to make more money. I mean, there are many stories about how much money they're making during the ransomware, but I mean, it's not hard to imagine that. I mean, the ransoms are millions of dollars. And millions of dollars are being paid for each infection. So imagine that you should get one infection. You're a hacker, you're a millionaire, and you're living in a country. So answer your question. Number one, it's not in the United States. I mean, these are not Americans going after Americans. There are foreign hackers. And I think that's a very important distinction. As soon as they get inside of the country, then we have our law enforcement. Right. And so that's part of why, it's because we can figure out if they're doing it from inside the country. So it's from outside the country that this is happening. And then, I mean, they can go. And then the other part is that it's hard right now to attribute back to who it is. Right now, for example, I mean, the Biden administration went and talked to Putin about ransomware. They did that. But there's really no evidence that it's Russia that would stand up in court of law. What they've done is they go and they can look at the binaries of the files and they can see some Russian characters in there. But that doesn't mean that the country of Russia did it. That could be the Chinese putting Russian characters in. So it would never stand up in a court of law. And so we need more, going back to the first thing we're talking about, software asset management, we need attribution on what software is on your network. If you can get attribution, it runs. If you have no attribution, then it doesn't run.
So basically you're saying that since we have ineffective punishment, this will continue to grow over time.
We have ineffective attribution.
Right.
Right, since you can't punish somebody you don't know who they are.
Right.
Right, and so that's the problem. I think that's what Biden was trying to do, is try to get Putin to agree, you know, okay, if we can find the person, then will you help us get them? And maybe they, but we still can't find these people.
So instead of always being on defensive, do you foresee any evolution of software that can reduce your exposure from the current day?
Yes. I mean, that's what I talk about, software asset management, hardware asset management. So I think that there should be a whole wave of software asset management software. This has all been very well documented by the federal government about how to do this.
And so in your view, to conclude, is what knowledge and wisdom do you think our viewers should have? First question. Second question, what is the reality versus perception?
You know, the thing that why I keep on going, I mean, my company, as you know, it's been very good for me, and so I don't have to work, but I do worry about, you know, a nation state attack. Like I said, there is not a national defense. So once it happens, we're all on our own. And so that does scare me. I mean, and what would happen is, number one, it would shut down the cyber, not the country, like the electric grid or something, but the cyber, our reliance on computers, however much we are reliant on computers, that will be shut down.
On all technology, correct?
Yes. You know, and that every, you know, year we're so reliant more on technology like that. And then the other thing that they can do is they can just blast us with all these bots, turn them against us, and it would put the country to its knees. And so I'm working with the federal government and trying to find ways so that we can go and create cybersecurity that will withstand these kind of things. I do think that the first country that figures out how to withstand these kind of attacks wins. And I think that if we can go and present, I mean, we will be so much stronger as a nation once we figure out how to protect ourselves from cyber attacks. And I think that, I mean, right now we are in a position to be the number one as far on protection.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, but we still have a long ways to go.
Right. And you mentioned the Internet of Things. There's 15 billion devices with no software protection. What would be your plan to improve that defense?
Okay, I do have a plan. It's all going to be in my book, Ben. So yeah, Internet of Things is one of the things I'm working with the Department of Homeland Security on. It is a very large concern. Also, one of the things is just Android TV. They just came into the country. There were millions of them, and they all had what we call a bot software on there.
And where were they manufactured?
They were manufactured in China.
Okay.
So somehow, we don't know who made this, but somehow that manufacturer got compromised and they got in, they were able to get it on all these Android TVs. And then it got in the country. These are in the country now. There are millions of them in the country now. We don't know whether people bought them and they're on a network. They all could be in a warehouse, right? And that would be good. We don't want them on the network until they get that bot software on there, because a bot is a piece of software that just sits there and does nothing until it gets a command. And the command says, go attack this. And so now there are millions of these that could potentially be on a network. And we don't really have a mechanism to get them out of the country or get them updated. And so these are the things that, you know, I'm worried about. So my solution to this is, number one, everything that comes inside the country, it needs to have security software on there. Also have some way of updating itself, so if it's compromised, it can get uncompromised. And then the problem right now is we have a foreign enemy in cyber. Sometimes it could be a nation state attack. It could be people that are profiteering off of the security holes, whatever it is. But there is a way to control external traffic from the country. I think the country should be independent of the of foreign countries on cyber. We should be able to buy everything from Amazon or wherever we are, stream Netflix, and we should not have a dependence on any other country throughout the world. And so that's the largest security hole of all, is that we are, for whatever reason, dependent on other countries for cyber. So if the government, and so, you know, it's, the internet is only coming in through so many places into the United States. And then the government does control that. And so the government should have some way of being able to turn off that and turn it back on again. And so I am working with DHS on that as well. And then if we can make it so all the things inside the country have security software so they can't attack us, then that would be a solution to that problem.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. It's our first podcast for Insights. And I feel that at least myself became a little bit more knowledgeable. And the reality versus the perception has changed my view on cyber. But thank you again, and we'll look forward to speaking to you soon.
It's my pleasure, Ben.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.